In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with one of the country's best-known anthropologists. His name is Marshall Solins. He's now an emeritus professor at the University of Chicago. He grew up in Chicago and did his undergraduate work at University of Michigan, his graduate work both there and at Columbia. He taught anthropology both those places and then came back to Chicago and joined the faculty at University of Chicago in 1973. He's spending time here on this campus, here this week and next, as a George A. Miller Endowment Visiting Professor. We'll be giving a talk, in fact, in the MillerCom series tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. These are always free and open to the public. Anyone interested in attending can do that. Perhaps we'll talk a little bit about the talk to give you an idea of subject matter, and then you might want to go and hear him. And of course, as we talk here this morning, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point, questions and comments certainly are welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Tell me about the talk for tonight. I'm a bit mystified.
The title is Culture and Agency in History. It takes off from a problem in Thucydides' famous history of the Peloponnesian War, but you could find it in almost any history, which is the problem of sometimes there are the acting units of history, what we call the agents or subjects of history, are whole entities like the Athenians or the Spartans. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there are characters like Pericles or Themistocles. And my question is, when does history have as its main subject, as its agent, as its acting unit, an entity like Athens? And when is it some particular when do individuals intervene in history? And as a teaser, I will say that the answer to that question begins by a comparison of the New York Giants World Pennant of 1951, won by Bobby Thompson in the last half of the last inning of a playoff game, which you might remember if you're as old as I am.
A little before my time.
And the comparison with that and the Yankees victory of 1939, which is certainly before your time, although not quite before mine, which the Yankees won going away from the beginning of the season. And the Yankees are an indication of a collective agent. Bobby Thompson is an individual hero, and I try to talk about what the differences are in these kinds of events, these kinds of histories that sometimes bring units to the fore, and some or groups or communities or nations, and sometimes individuals.
Well, it's interesting because I think that we seem to be in a time now where we have come to believe that there aren't individual heroes anymore.
There might not be heroes, but there are certainly individuals at critical junctures influencing events. I mean, witness one Catherine Harris or Antonin Scalia, who decided the last presidential election. or another of the examples I'm going to use tonight concerns Elian Gonzalez and the Gonzalez family, who played an important role in international relations last year, in Cuban-American relations. It's not quite true that people, there are events which are critical turning points in which people, they might not be great heroes, they might not be, they might have greatness thrust upon them, but there they are, influencing the course of events. Some of them have only 15 minutes of immortality, like Monica Lewinsky, but there they are.
Yeah. One thing that I'd wanted to ask you about is perhaps you could talk a little bit about what cultural anthropologists do and how within the field people are thinking differently and have been thinking differently, certainly maybe within the past 15, 20 years, about what it is that they're all about.
Well, what's different now is that nobody can go to some isolated tribe, people, community, and think they're going to study a whole culture independent of the whole rest of the world. Globalization has caught up with everybody. There is no isolated people anymore anywhere. And everybody's living, therefore, in a global world, consuming products and being exposed to media and so forth, which have a global origin, or at least a Western capitalist origin, and their own lives in this community. And so that nowadays we have We have something which people like to call hybridization, although I don't like the word so much, but local appropriations of the global, you might say, local, based on their own indigenous culture, some way of organizing the experience of the forces impinging upon them. And those are, that's a big problem nowadays. It doesn't mean these cultures are disappearing. On the contrary, this curious thing that's happening is that they're becoming more integrated in the world, but they're also at the same time differentiating by the way that they become capitalists, or the way they assume our products, or the way that they relate to the political world. And one of the things that has come to the fore in this, in fact, is the notion of culture itself. Everybody now has a culture. 20 years ago, you know, people just lived, and now they've got a culture that they're defending, that they articulate, that they invoke their ancestors about, and which helps them deal with the exigencies of the modern world. Yeah. So one of the more interesting phenomena of the late 20th, early 21st century is sort of cultural consciousness all around the world.
Yeah. I'm interested to hear you talk about the fact that cultures may be changing, they may be adapting, they're not necessarily being lost, and because this is something that people seem to be very concerned about, that is, as the culture of the developed industrial Western world, which is mostly the culture of the United States, right, engulfs the world, people are concerned that indeed cultures are being lost, ways of belief, of faith, language, of living, that those things are.
There are losses. It would be insane to deny that there are not, you know, things are the same. Things, elements of the traditional cultures have been changed. There is no doubt about it. But they were changed in the past, too. The question is whether the way they change is traditional or not. And that, I think, is answerable from the point of view that they are changing according to their measures of their own tradition and the way the world should be according to their views. In that sense, their culture still exists, although elements of it obviously have been modified, transformed. I lived in a village in Fiji a few years ago, which was both the most modern village and the most conservative village in Fiji. It had sidewalks, garbage collection, and electricity, something that most villages don't have. It also had its own bus service. But all of this was organized by the clan system, which was alive and well in this village more than in other Fijian villages, precisely because it was organizing the bus system, the construction of sidewalks, which divided one clan from another, and so on. So that the system was at the one and the same time becoming integrated in the modern world and doing so in its own terms.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Marshall Solins. He is now visiting the campus of the University of Illinois as a Miller Endowment Visiting Professor. He is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at University of Chicago. Questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. We'll start out here with a caller on our toll-free line, number 4. Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Yes.
The students that are in your classes at the University of Chicago, could you break down and kind of enlarging on what David said, what kind of work do these students go into when they graduate?
Well, first of all, it depends on what they've done, for their degrees. A lot of them go into academic work. There's no question about that. But they are doing a lot of work around the world that's rather unusual. I'm working in Eastern Europe. I have a student working on the media on television and its presentation of family life in Brazil, and she is now working on a major Brazilian newspaper. But most people who graduate with PhDs in anthropology are destined, I think, for academic or museum work, something of that sort.
Well, what if they don't have a PhD?
They don't have a PhD. They enter the labor market with certain skills, but it can range anywhere from marketing, which is sometimes useful to have an anthropology degree in the sense that you can go out and do field work about what people want and don't want, to diplomatic work and things of that sort.
Thank you so much.
All right. Other questions are certainly welcome. You can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. There was a time, I think not very long ago, that within anthropology people were questioning the what we think of as being the traditional activity of the cultural anthropologist, as you say, to go to some remote place, a culture very different from yours, where you have to go and you have to learn another language and get to know a group of people that's completely different from you. There seemed to be a lot of questioning about whether, in fact, that was appropriate to do that, and that maybe if you're an American and you're an anthropologist, that what you should be doing is studying America, study your own culture, not going someplace else.
I think anthropology's always taken the position, I think it's a justifiable one, that it's not the easiest thing in the world to understand your own culture without having some understanding or difference to contrast it with, and without knowing the range of variation there is in the world and what kind of changes are possible in a culture and what kinds of changes are unlikely. And it seems to me that anthropologists still maintain the sense that cultural differences are necessary to understand, A, what culture is, and certainly, B, what man is, which is our larger goal.
Mm-hmm. Well, what really can...
I shouldn't, men and women.
indeed. What can an American anthropologist, you're going to another culture, what can one hope to learn and do as a result of that?
Well, you mean about the culture or about the in America?
No, I mean about the, I guess I'm thinking in regards to that culture that you're studying.
What you can learn and do?
Yeah.
Depends on how long you take to do your work. And it is the case in anthropology that increasingly none of us feel that our commitments to any particular place we've worked are finished after a year or two, which is the normal first field work. Most of us go back time and time again because it takes an awful long time to understand the intricacies of a society. But I think that just as when one learns a language, one begins to learn, when one learns a foreign language, one begins to learn differences in the way people are thinking, how things are related, how genders are related to political processes or to objects of the world, to nature and so on, differently in different languages. So in the culture as a whole, a long period of study allows you to understand the way this group is organized, how its people are related to each other and to the objects of their existence and to nature. And that can be done. I mean, you can understand something. Let me give you an example. I mean, anthropology starts off with things that are very remote and perhaps even repulsive to us. For example, I work in Fiji where cannibalism was rampant until the middle of the 19th century and perhaps occasionally since then. And cannibalism is something that is, on the face of it, remote and illogical to us, leaving aside the Eucharist. Let me tell you how you begin to understand it. I read a passage, for example, in a work done by an anthropologist in the early 20th century, where he was describing a chief who had a great canoe built by a specialized carpenter, which normally would require a great reward. When the carpenter came for his reward, for his feast and reward, the chief said to him, "I'm sorry, I can't bring you a raw woman or a man, or a cooked man, because Christianity has spoiled our feasts." Now, what could he possibly mean? Well, a raw woman, that's pretty obvious, meant a virgin woman. A cooked man meant a cannibal victim who had been sacrificed to the god and then, in communion with the god, as it were, eaten also by human beings. But why were these two things equal? That would be the first question. I mean, how could you substitute one for the other? Well, if you begin to examine the culture, you begin to see that they are equal in one important sense. They have what you might call as the same purpose, the same finality in the culture, and that is that they are both reproductive. The one reproductive directly, the women, through the bearing of children. The cannibal victim, as a sacrifice to the god, brings the intervention of the god on behalf of man. You might say that cannibalism was for men what birth was for women in this society. Now, David is shaking his head, saying he understands. Now, that's one of the beauties about anthropology, is that these things which are foreign to us can become intelligible, and intelligible in a very particular way, namely logical. Mm-hmm. Now, they become logical, and logic is something going on inside us. And this is the frightening and interesting thing about anthropology, namely a logic that is built into a culture, since it is built by men and women, and it's built in a way that's meaningful and therefore logical, can be appropriate, can be understood by an anthropologist because it is logical by running it through his or her mind, provided he or she makes the proper premises. Like, you can't exchange a cannibal victim for a raw woman. Okay, we understand what exchange is, equality is, equivalence is. Okay, well, these are the same. Now, why are they the same? And then you come to some sort of explanation such as I gave, so that you've run through your mind the way the world was constructed for them, because you are of the same nature as they, a thinking, feeling human being. And we have this great power that I think physicists don't have, who have to deal with objects which they'll never know the nature. I mean, you'll never know the nature of a rockiness. In fact, the more you know about a rock when you get to its molecular or quantum mechanics level, the more weird it becomes. Instead of the more, you won't shake your head at quantum mechanics because you'd have to think of something that's in the same two different places at the same time, which is great, impossible without mathematical equations. So the more that we know about physical objects, the less logical, the less familiar they are to us, whereas the more we know about human things, the more we can understand them because we're human beings. And I think if you ask what an American can do, I'd say, not it's an American as long as he or she is willing to suspend the American logic for the purpose of understanding and say, you know, that a raw woman can be exchanged against a cooked man, then you can understand in a way that's extremely powerful about how this society is constructed.
Mm. Well, there, it seems to me you put your finger on one of the difficulties, and that is, as we're told, anthropologists, in they're doing what they do, are supposed to suspend judgment. That is, they're supposed to simply, if you go someplace, you're simply supposed to record. You're not supposed to intervene. You see something you think is wrong, you don't like.
That's a moral problem which can impinge on your fieldwork. I mean, there are two issues here. First of all, the question of suspension of judgment. I think that is possible inside the when you talk about what is entailed, which is you're not suspending judgment. You're substituting the things that brought this custom into being for your own judgments about it. I mean, you're talking about sacrifice and so on that are involved in the rituals of cannibalism in the Fiji Islands. You want to relate this thing to what it is related to, and that's what suspending of judgment consists of. And I think that's possible. When it impinges on you, that is a problem that we all face in the field, and we have moral dilemmas of various kinds. I mean, people come in, when I was working first in the 50s in the Fiji, people came in and tried to exploit the manganese resources of the island I was in, and they were going to do it in a way that was obviously detrimental to these people, and I did intervene. I've also intervened when violence was going on in a place where I had control over it. So I have done that.
Hmm. We are just about at our midpoint here. Let me introduce again our guest. We're talking with Marshall Solins. He's an emeritus professor of anthropology at University of Chicago and is spending some time on this campus as a Miller Endowment visiting professor. He'll be giving a talk tonight in the MillerCom series. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you might stop by at the Levis Faculty Center, 7:30 tonight. As he explained at the beginning of the program, we'll be talking about the fact that in history, sometimes the chief agents are entities like nation states, and sometimes they're individuals. And he'll give a number of examples. That's a talk on culture and agency in history tonight on the campus. Here we're talking a little bit about anthropology and what it is and perhaps how it has changed. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. How is it that you became interested in the cultures of the Pacific, and did your work in Fiji and Hawaii and places like that?
Well, I'm sure I was partly a victim of what we're all a victim of, the South Sea Paradise dream. You know, I used to read things like Mutiny on the Bounty and so on. So that sort of experience. The other, it was sort of more technical in the sense that as a graduate student at Columbia, I was working on a certain kind of social organization, which was really best exemplified in the Polynesian Islands, which are the islands everywhere, Hawaii, Easter Island, all the way to New Zealand. And a place where I could do further work on this particular organization was Fiji. So in terms of where it was still an ongoing, observable, working system, and so I decided to do that there.
Let's take a caller here on the campus, line one. Hello.
Hello. I wanted to return to the question of whether or not anthropologists can study his or her own culture, and I wanted to ask you what your opinion is of the concept of autoethnography. I'm not an anthropologist, but I'm interested in personal narratives written by people who are doing the kind of cross-cultural comparison. Say they grow up in one culture and then they get an education in another, and they're writing about that space between and how they're trying to find themselves. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on it.
Well, yeah, actually, I think it's quite a valuable and interesting activity, and one of the more interesting aspects of it is that some of the people who are doing it are, in fact, very high-level, high-power intellectuals now. I mean, intellectuals, third world intellectuals who have come to the United States and are teaching in the United States or in Britain are some of the most important people in the human sciences these days, precisely because of that experience. And it sort of underlines what I said about it's to know one's own culture, it's very useful to have some experience of difference and what other possibilities are.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm really getting at is the problem of being too subjective, you know, when you're so close to the culture you're part of that even though you have a comparative perspective, you can't realize a moral problem because you're too wrapped up in it. You know,
I think that that's not a problem with doing this work in the sense that if you don't know the solution, at least you produce the problem. So this can become people's responses under those situations or their subjective views of the world are themselves, you might say, data for other people to use to think about and to perhaps come to some conclusion about, which is based on a wider understanding. So there's nothing, you know, it's always a question of whether, you know, it's always a question of whether you're talking about yourself or you're talking about somebody else when you're doing this kind of thing.
Right.
But even if you're talking about yourself when you're doing so and judging another culture or judging your own experience in another culture, it becomes so useful because it becomes evident to everybody, and then it becomes something that you can work on and try to understand.
So. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, and again, other questions are welcome. Number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about, again, this idea of how Western anthropologists have approached cultures other than their own, and how that has changed over time from, it seems that a period when there was a lot of judgment going on. There was an us and them argued from a position, they would say, of moral and cultural superiority, to a point where the idea seemed to be, well, there's really no way that we can do that. We can't say our culture is better than their culture. And then it seems like now we've come to another point that may be, in some sense, midway between the other two, where we are perhaps trying to make a more honest appraisal of these cultures that are other than ours.
Yeah. I think anthropology started off with a view of these other societies as useful lessons. I mean, you think of Margaret Mead's works about coming of age in Samoa, where she said, here you have a society where the adolescence is not traumatic, and we could do that too if we would just put purpose in our hearts. And so, I mean, that was a kind of, in some ways you could think of that as a kind of intellectual colonization. Is as if these people live their lives just to provide salutary lessons for us to live ours. And I think that anthropologists got over that to some extent, or at least I hope they did. And they began to, the first thing they had to realize is that these people didn't live and die just to manure the growth of our society. I mean, they had their own problems, and they were solving them in their own ways. And that has become, I think, sort of the most fundamental sort of culturally relative premise of anthropology. I mean, they produce their own mode of existence. The second thing is that I think that's relevant to that is that anthropologists, again, I would say, in order to understand this, cannot go in and simply make a judgment. This is good or this is bad, because that cuts off the understanding of how it came to be, and how what people themselves consider it, and how they react toward it, and what their relations to these customs are. So that in order to understand the society, anything in a particular society, you have to relate it to the other things in that society, not to your society. A priori. And this doesn't mean that you can't make judgments about your society or their society outside of that context, and which I think all of us will do and do. But the word we used before, suspend, I think is relevant. You have to, when you go there and when you're trying to understand it, you have to relate it to what is there, not what is in your place.
Mm. I'm interested in the in Captain Cook and the Hawaiians. That you wrote a book that apparently touched off some controversy,
right.
Looking at this issue of what did the Hawaiians think when Captain Cook showed up? And here, as I just understand it from just reading about it and not actually having read the book, the idea that at one point we said, well, the Hawaiians thought that Captain Cook was a god when he showed up, and one can imagine that it would be as for us as if someone came from another planet. It was that much of a sort of a surprise and a shock to see this individual show up on your doorstep. From that, going to a viewpoint that said, no, of course not. The Hawaiians weren't stupid. They knew Captain Cook was not a god, that he was another human being. Yeah, maybe he was different from them, but no, they didn't. To yet another understanding that says, well, now let's try and put ourselves in the place of the Hawaiians and think about how, given their culture and their way of looking at the world, how they would have seen things. And maybe then that leads us back to the first point, and yet for a slightly different reason of saying, yeah, well, maybe they did think that way.
Yeah, well, as far as the middle point was concerned, he was just a man and not a god. I don't know why people who come from a Christian tradition find this difficult to understand in the first place. I mean, are you going to say, yeah, Jesus Christ was just a man and not a god? The fact that, and neither that culture nor ours, the fact that a person is a man doesn't mean he's not a god. So that's the first premise that you have to get through your heads. That is to say that there are some people in traditional Polynesian societies, notably high chiefs who are forms of the god on this earth. Doesn't mean that they're not men. They're precisely men and individuals, but they are at the same time forms of the god. And the fact that they are forms of a god doesn't mean there isn't also the god somewhere else of which they are the forms. So just like the notion of the Trinity, that notion, I mean, if you could expand that notion to Hawaii, you would understand something about the way you could be both rational, human, believe that people are individuals, and believe they are also manifestations of something divine. In the case of Cook, I think that, yes, the problem here was that you can't impose precisely this other sort of scientific rationality, which we counterpose to that, in order to understand this Hawaiian saying, you know, this is, objectively speaking, a man. He must have come from England, wherever England was. I mean, how would the Hawaiians know that, what it was? In fact, everything over the horizon in Hawaii came from the sky, which is true, actually, if you look at an island and you look at the horizon, everything that comes from over the horizon comes from the heavens. So if you look at it in their terms, yes, you're right. I mean, the thought is, first of all, these terms are not so outrageous. They're not irrational. They are something that is true of many different religions. And in this case, what you said about the beginning, yes, this was totally a kind of unprecedented, in some ways, event. But in other ways, it fit into traditions. It came at a certain time of the year when the god appears. And he came from a place which the Hawaiians call Kahiki. Well, that's their word for Tahiti. And when Cook came, he said, well, they asked him where he was coming from, and he was coming from Tahiti, actually. So that there were many signs that they could pick up inside their own logic to attribute a meaning to this in their own terms, which is what they did. In my argument, I think, in my absolutely irreproachable argument about it. So I think that this is, it was a rational process. It was based upon characteristics of the event, insofar as they could understand it, related to what they knew about the world, the way they considered the world. In that sense, it was logical and rational. And even its apparent scandal that a man could be a god was something that, in fact, the people on board that ship also believed. It was not something new in the universe. Mm.
We have another caller in Crete to talk with here, line number 4. Hello.
You mentioned Margaret Mead. She used to be the personification of the anthropologist, the cultural anthropologist. When anybody wanted an anthropologist, they called on Margaret. Lately, her reputation has suffered a sea change. I just wonder if you could comment on Margaret Mead before she died and now the attacks upon her after her death.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I think the attack has been misplaced in some respects. The attack is just the sort of thing we were just talking about. I mean, she was irrational. She didn't understand the perfectly rational character of what she was dealing with, and that she was being misled by young women who pretended they were having sexual relations that they didn't really have. And she wrote a book that was misleading. Actually, I think the problem turns out to be more complicated. Both Margaret Mead and the critics, and especially the critic in Australia, Derek Freeman, I think are now considered to have equally mistaken a problem which is interestingly complicated. The problem is simply, to put it simply, something like this. The young women in these societies, while they remain virgins, are virgins because, in effect, they're married to the gods. The hula and all these kinds of dances and lasciviousness which they exhibit are to attract the gods and to bring them to earth, to fertilize the land. So the function of the young women in these societies is a sexual one while at the same time being virgins. And it's this kind of this ambiguity which misled Margaret Mead and brought the criticism upon her, but the criticism didn't recognize this characteristic of the Samoans and many Polynesians as well. So the you know, it's a kind of, I wouldn't say a plague on both your houses, but both of these people, both the critics and Margaret Mead, had problems with their arguments. But we all do. I mean, I've come to the conclusion after a certain number of years in anthropology that two things are true about the long run. One is that we'll be wrong, and the other is that we'll be dead. And obviously, a good a career comes when you're dead before you're wrong. this is a field that does develop certain criteria of understanding, and we do sort of progress in that.
I was thinking of this new controversy for the American Anthropology Association that's going to have some studies or a study.
You mean the South American one?
Yeah, this new book on
smallpox
vaccine was missing.
Yeah, right. Well, that was a complicated story, too, because it involved two characters and two different problems. And the book at issue is called Darkness in El Dorado by a man named Patrick Tierney, which caused a lot of controversy in the public media and, as you say, in the American Anthropological Association and elsewhere. And the two issues in the book got confounded, and the arguments. The two issues in the book were these people involved, these American scientists, and one a prominent anthropologist, one a prominent biologist and doctor, involved in the spread or even origin of a measles epidemic in the late 1960s, in a remote region of Venezuela, the answer to that seems to be no, they were not. I mean, more than seems to be, it seems clear that they were not. And the accusation of the book, which was about one-tenth of the book, actually, that they were, was wrong, which discredited the whole book, unfortunately, because the rest of the book concerned the activities of a certain anthropologist. I don't want to get involved in the controversy in any depth, but a certain anthropologist's mode of doing fieldwork, which caused some difficulties, indeed engendered some violence in the society concerned, and that those methods were not the kind of methods that would be sanctioned today in anthropological fieldwork. And there was a sustained documentation of that in the book. Now that part, which is about eight-tenths of the book, got lost in the whitewashing of the first problem. So now what's happened in the Anthropological Association is a committee has been formed to study fieldwork methods and what was done then and to recommend procedures so that it wouldn't happen again.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. It leads me to the question, I think, that, you know, the controversy about this man who was a very famous anthropologist. This would be the guy that, if you took anthropology 101, if you'd never heard about any other anthropologist, yeah, he would be one you no doubt would learn about because of his work with the people of the rainforest and Brazil or the Amazon. It gets back to this question, I think, aren't we kidding? If we really say that anthropologists doing field work will have no impact on the culture they're studying, that they're just going to stand back and they're going to take notes and then they're going to go and it'll be just like it was before they came. We're kidding ourselves if we say
well,
that.
Yes and no. In the case of the person concerned, we can name names, Napoleon Chagnon.
Napoleon Chagnon, yeah.
Yeah. He was dealing in a situation which is probably not repeatable. That is that he was on the Wild West frontier of an uncontrolled, this was in the 60s, of an uncontrolled area in which it's not true, as was sometimes alleged, including by him, that he was the first European in certain places, but he was certainly one of the few people at that time, and he was supplying these people with goods of extreme value to them. Such value, it's not simply that these steel goods were good tools. They were used almost as jewels in exchange relations with between Indian groups, and anybody who got them could become powerful in a region get women through bride exchange with these goods and so on. So people were jealous of what he was doing with his people, and they would attack the people he was with, and he and people in his village that he didn't give these things to would get angry with him, and he'd have to leave the village. That kind of thing is a very rare situation today. I mean, if I did fieldwork in the Fiji Islands in starting in 1954, it shows you how old I am, and they those people had already had 120 years of contacts with Europeans, and it was hardly likely that anything that I was going to do was going to change their existence. On the contrary, when I violated their rules, which I did constantly, mostly through ignorance, they would tell me things like, "Well, you know, white men and children sit under coconut trees, but they're the only ones."
Well, did Chagnon, you know, I think what he did after doing that work, and he wrote books and documentary movies were made and presented the culture of these people in a particular kind of way. Were we, in fact, seeing the culture of those people as it was, or was there a distortion in that culture as either the result of carelessness on his part or deliberate acts on his part that then presented these people in a very different light from what they really were?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no doubt that there was an exaggeration of their violence, and that in several respects. First of all, that the groups that he was dealing with come from very peaceful areas but had moved down into a trading area and were in a situation which was itself more of a violent situation. So the notion that those people as a people were violent, judging from some small fraction of them that were in a situation of warfare, was incorrect. Secondly, the notion that was translated as fierce, these are the famous fierce people, actually is a very complex notion among these people, and it includes the notions of valor, generosity, and humor, including the ability to tell jokes not only about other people but on yourself. And that's what makes a person a big man in that society. There were many different roads to status in that society, many different ways that one could achieve this high standing, including magical killings as well as actual killings. But mostly, you know, the point is that 90% or 95% or whatever large fraction of their lives was spent, and they were a very humorous, generous people. And that there have been many anthropologists down there, actually something like 36 people have studied them, and there have been many criticisms of the notion that they are crazy, violent a lot by the others. Chagnon went from village to village doing these medical projects, and he carried out these kinds of campaigns in which he in fact violated very fundamental taboos. I mean, he had to have everybody's names for the medical studies he was doing, the genealogies that were necessary. But they never mentioned their own names or names of the dead. The names you call out of the enemy's names when you're going to fight them, it's a way of insulting them. So here he was collecting genealogies in a situation where it was absolutely prohibited. In fact, it was a condition of their existence that they don't mention the names of the dead. And he was inciting this kind of problem. And when they were hostile to them, they became a fierce people. But other anthropologists, you know, sit down, they say, okay, you can't do genealogies here. I'm going to live without that. They're living without that, and are not antagonizing them. And found that, there's one anthropologist married a local woman who wrote a book, a long, long book about how wonderful these people were. So, I mean, it's true that some of them were quite violent, but no more than a lot of other people in South America, and certainly a lot more than most of the other Yanomami.
We're going to have one more caller here. We're trying to squeeze him in there in Chicago on our line 4. Hello.
Thank you. Bernard Shaw was quoted as saying, The only thing that separates America and England is the language.
Yeah. Two countries divided by a common language.
And it seems that of the thousands of language and dialects throughout the world, it's this aspect of logic that is imparted, as you gave an illustration earlier about the lifestyle down there in different parts of the world. The logic is separating and the understanding of the diffusion of languages. I wonder what traffic signals we're going to have to impose, if we must, to curtail so much of the savagery and other things that were going on then as well as now among different cultures without trampling them. But I think language has got a way to go to clarify our purpose as humans and persons on the planet, and I think we need some traffic signals to get things cleared up.
Yeah. I think the problem is, the problem of violence is, of course, serious and requires more than logic. But the language problem, I'm not so sure, is a difficulty, because I think there are some universals in language that allow you, provided you make some assumptions, to understand each other. There are universals like negation, equivalence, assertions, questions. There are logical operations, you might say, that are true in many different languages. The thing is that when we say something is the same as another thing in our society, what we might consider the same in another society would consider different. And the question is whether we can make that jump. That is the way I try to explain with, say, raw women and cooked men. Can we, as being exchangeable? Well, we know that what the same means. I mean, when Fijians say these are the same, okay, we know what that, but why should they say these particular things are the same? That's the issue. And I think we can, with further investigation, deal with that kind of problem.
We must stop because we've used our time. I want to say, Professor Solins, thank you for being with us. Our guest, Marshall Solins, he's Emeritus Professor of Anthropology, University of Chicago. And again, he'll be talking about culture and agency in history as part of the MillerCom series tonight on the U of I campus, 7:30 at the Levis Center. Open to the public. Anyone who would like to attend should feel welcome.